Here are some of the news headlines we're watching.
By the time the conference was over, the president won a pledge.
So are Americans worshiping government over God?
An extremely rare safety move by a nation.
17 years, the Palestinians and Israelis negotiated.
This idea just is not...
We hear a lot of
Hi, friends. Welcome to In the Market with Janet Parshall. So if you're walking around in that cacophony you just heard known as the Marketplace of Ideas, you and I both know that one of the most populated booths in that marketplace is going to be the one that deals with money, finances. How do I know? Because we all think about it, by the way. It has a propensity to take up a lot of space in terms of our heart. And I'll tell you why I know that this is a big topic, because God said it was going to be a big topic. He talks an awful lot in his inspired, inerrant, transcendent, immutable word about the subject of money. He uses it as a teaching tool. He tells us about debt. He gives us guidance. He tells us stories about talents. The list goes on and on and on. And he knew it would be a struggle because he said there's this inexorable linkage between your heart and your money. So how do we love God with our whole heart and yet make wise decisions about our money? Because boy, I tell you what, thank you, Campus Crusade for Christ and Dr. Bill Bright. Remember that idea that he said there's a throne in your heart and who sits on it is your decision. Are you going to make Christ the center of your life? Or are you going to push it off and replace it with some other demigod, some other temporal idol? And so often that idol looks an awful lot like a greenback, doesn't it? So we're going to talk today about something called whole heart finances. I love that because immediately this isn't just about figures in a ledger. This is about loving God with our whole heart, including loving him in the way in which we handle our finances. So the full title of the book we're going to talk about is called Whole Heart Finances, A Jesus-Centered Guide to Managing Your Money with Joy. Ooh, sign me up for that, because I want Christ to be the center of all things, including the way in which I handle my finances. So we have a superb teacher with us, and that's exactly who he is. Dr. Shane Enett is an associate professor of finance at Biola University, where he is the director of the Kroll School of Business's Financial Planning Program. He's got a PhD in personal financial planning, a master's degree in mathematical finance, and a professional designations as a chartered financial analyst called a CFA and a certified financial planner called a CFP. Through teaching, speaking, and writing, he hopes to empower Christians to love God with all their heart, which includes their finances. Hence, it follows the title of his book would be Whole Heart Finances, which is, I'm going to date myself, very much of a think and do book. And if you know what that is, you're as old as I am. In other words, you are required to write in this book and to take notes. We'll get into that in a minute. But Dr. Enett, I want to thank you first and foremost for the gift of your time and your wisdom and tackling this tough subject. But for a fellow who has multiple degrees in finances, where did that love of finances and all things ledgers and figures come from?
Thanks so much, Jana, for having me. You know what? The love of finance came about in 1995. There's a moment I can kind of trace it back to. Mm. And for me, I was 15 and I received a book, and it was from my uncle, and the book was called How to Invest $50,000 to $5,000. It's kind of one of those classics. And it was just the title of the book that got me incredibly interested in money. And what it did was it showed me that that this information was out there, and I was kind of always interested in managing money, just, you know, saving and buying things, you know, as a kid. But in that moment when I got this book, it was the first time I realized that there was a whole wealth of information and I could just go out and learn it. And so I didn't even open the book. I just put it down and I went to the library and I went to the Barnes & Noble. I came home with about 25 books, and they were all related to money and investing. And I just started learning. And, this was right before the internet kind of came of age. And so everyone learned through these investment clubs. And so I found my local investment club and went and started attending and kind of learned their process. And then they noticed me because I was so young, and they're like, do you want to lead a teen investing seminar? And so I started teaching investing, you know, in high school. And that just set me off in this path. And wow. Haven't looked back since.
Wow. I'm so glad I asked you that question. How fascinating. And talk about being focused, laser focused at 15 to start this. So where were you? I see where you were financially and how you fell in love with this idea of growing wealth. But where were you spiritually at that time?
So I grew up in a Christian household, and you know, but Jesus and God were kind of parts to play in the play of please your parents, and so it was more of a cultural thing, and I was a dutiful son. But in 1993, so when I was 13, so 2 years before I got this book, I was got locked outside of the house, and I was all alone on a summer day, and I ended up deciding I was going to climb the side of the house. Like there was a tree and there was a balcony that was open that I knew I could get in on. And I thought I, you know, overestimated my abilities. And so I ended up getting to the balcony, but kind of slipping and falling two stories down onto an iron rod fence.
Ooh.
And then it was impaled kind of through my inner thigh area, and the spike broke off, and then just kind of like cauterized the wound to where I didn't bleed out. I should have died. And to this day, I can feel the wind kind of pass by my ear as I fell. And so I ended up, and my parents came, or my dad came home right then by God's providence, and we should have called the ambulance, but I was still alive and awake. And so we just drove on the 405 freeway, which is a real crowded freeway here in California, to the hospital. And so there was a 16-hour surgery. The moment they saw the spike was like inside of my stomach, and not to get too gruesome, but I woke up and I was still alive, and the surgeon was so he was so proud I was still alive that he wanted to keep the spike that he had just extracted from me, but I kept it, and now my wife is the proud owner of it. And so it was in that hospital room that I encountered the personal love of God. And I was this bag of bones, you know, got down to 70 pounds, had nothing to offer God or anyone else. And it was in the right side of the room I felt God's presence, and I felt Jesus' smile. And I still to this day can remember feeling so proud that God knew me and he loved me. And it was just this life-changing moment.
Wow, what a story. I just love hearing about other people's pilgrim's progress. Thank you for that. Well, with that as a background, I'm anxious to get your approach toward finances because, again, my dollars aren't over there and my life relationship with Christ is over there. The two have to be linked together. So how do I love him and serve him with my whole heart? Your answer, by applying whole heart finances. We're going to learn what that is when we return with Dr. Shane Enit. Stay with us. We are just getting started. The Bible says those who seek will find. That means if you're looking for biblical answers to questions the world is asking, you will find them. And it's why I've chosen Seek as this month's truth tool. Get biblical answers to multiple questions on God, society, theology, and more. Ask for your copy of Seek when you give a gift of any amount to In the Market. Call 877-JANET-58, that's 877-JANET-58, or go to inthemarketwithjanetpartial.org. We are visiting with Dr. Shane Enit. He is a professor at Biola University, dealing in the world of finances there. But he's also joining us today as the author of this book, Whole Heart Finances, A Jesus-Centered Guide to Managing Your Money with Joy. You have so many pragmatic steps in this book. I appreciate that very, very much because that's the way I think with my feet planted firmly on terra firma. So I love pragmatics. But I did want to ask you as we start out, as you view people, particularly followers of Christ, in their intersection with money, what is the biggest mistake we have in our thinking as Christians, as followers of Christ, when it comes to our finances?
You know what? I think probably what people, they just assume, they think they know what Jesus is going to say about money. And there's just this very vivid story in the Gospels about Jesus and the rich young ruler. And so everyone puts themselves in the place of the rich young ruler, and they assume if they kind of came to him with their bank statements or with their retirement portfolio or any kind of savings account number, that Jesus would kind of look at it, be very, very, you know, maybe upset or angry or kind of disapprove of money itself, and then just kind of say, you know, just get rid of this. Like, you need to follow me. This is something that's not important. And so whenever I ask people, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus say if you honestly kind of presented your financial situation to him? they just say, oh, he would kind of disapprove of the money and want me to give everything away. And it's kind of, it's a big mistake to assume that Jesus is mostly assuming he's only spiritual and he's actually not encountered both a physical life where he had to make financial decisions, but also ascended with a physical body to where he's always going to sympathize with our financial needs and our physical needs. And and so he's very trustworthy. So I think that's the top mistake right out the gate.
That's a fascinating answer. So where does this misfiguring of the scriptures come from? In other words, let me say in my language back to you what I just heard you say. Somehow it's more godly to take a vow of poverty, that somehow wealth is anathema to a relationship with Jesus Christ. Where do we get that from? Because I don't think that's what the scripture says.
Yeah. You know, Dallas Willard, who was a professor of philosophy at USC, he wrote a lot of really great spiritual formation books. He was a professor at USC when I was there. He said that in Jesus's time, the people assumed, well, if you were wealthy, you were favored by God, because wealth was how you would fulfill the Great Commission or the original commission of be fruitful and, or I guess the Christian mandate, as they say. And so if you had wealth, you were blessed and you were more spiritual. And then if you didn't have wealth, that meant you did something wrong and you were sinful. And in today's culture, it's actually gone fully reverse to where people assume that wealth is cursed and you can't actually be intimate with Jesus if you have wealth, and that there is a certain spirituality in poverty. And they think wealth is a type of lever, so you can pull it to get less spiritual if you have it, and then you can pull it to get more spiritual if you don't have it. And, you know, I'd say it's just cultural phenomenon of there's quite a few different generational things happening. The Jewish kind of early Jewish church saw the Christian mandate as the mandate for them. And so wealth was intrinsically good as God's creation. And there's truth to that, you know, and there is truth to that there is danger in wealth. And so often it is something people pursue in light and in lieu of God. But I'm not exactly sure how we got to this point, if I'm to be honest.
but it does represent some bad eisegesis, if I can put it that way, that we've somehow picked up along the way. You know, when we go to the story of the rich young ruler, there are three descriptors there: rich, young, and he has a position of power. He's a ruler. We focus in on the rich part. We know the story doesn't end real well. So somehow the takeaway is, if he hadn't been rich, forget the young and the ruler part, but he hadn't been rich, then he would have made the right decision. But his money kept him from loving the Lord. Now, there is a truth in that I want to extrapolate out for a minute. So when the Bible talks about this connection between our treasure and our heart, and this goes to your whole thesis behind whole heart finances, why is there such a linkage between the two?
Yeah, there's... there's something about, it's connected to just about every part of our life that's important in terms of our shelter and our clothing and our food. All of that requires money. And it really is, you know, Jesus understands that these are things we need. And so when he's talking about how these are things that the Father wants to provide because he's a good Father, he's saying you don't have to chase after those things first. You know, you can seek the first the kingdom, but there's something just because we are these vulnerable, finite creatures, at least on this earth, we just care deeply about whether we're cold and whether we have shelter, whether we're fed. You know, it's natural. I don't think it's anything to be discouraged about. And that's why I love to connect that to Jesus, because he also felt those things. He felt cold. He felt the need for food, for shelter. And so he's not looking at us kind of saying, like, why do you care so much about how you're, you know, whether you're going to enjoy your next meal or what kind of clothing you're wearing? He knows. And he can rejoice with us because we're actually in his body now. And so there's a certain sense that if we have good coffee, he's going to enjoy that with us and not just be, you know, like, oh, why are you all up in this physical stuff, you know? He still has that body, yeah.
Exactly. Well, and if there is this linkage, and there most assuredly is, because the Bible talks an awful lot about money, it's not a topic that's in absentia in the scriptures by any stretch of the imagination, then there is stated and impliedly both a way in which we can honor God. And this goes to your whole heart finances. So I'm going to give you some rudimentary questions, but I want to build this platform a little bit. So does Jesus care about our money and how we handle it?
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
He cares about it so much that it's a way we could love him more.
Now that's the intriguing part of your entire book, that we can love God more based on the way in which we handle our finances. And for many of you, you're going, well, how does that work? It's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because we're going to tackle that this hour with Dr. Shane Enit. He's the author of Whole Heart Finances, a Jesus-centered guide. There's a little hint on the answer to managing your money with joy, not being stressed out about it, not wringing your hands about it, not worrying every day. But in fact, you can do this with joy. We're going to learn more on how we can do just that when we return. Dr. Shane Enit is an associate professor of finance at Biola University, and he joins us today as the author of Whole Heart Finances. And I love the subtitle of his book, A Jesus-Centered Guide to Managing Your Money with Joy. So it raises an interesting question. For us to have the right attitude, this is like being a rocket scientist. If our trajectory is right, we're going to land the right place. If it's off by 1 degree, we land in the wrong place. So what should our attitude be toward our finances? Do we say, I earned it by the sweat of my brow, therefore it's my money? Or do we go back to that idea that we are not owners, but we are managers, and God has placed that money in our lives? And if he is the one who has put that money in our lives, there's a presupposition there, which is he must want us to do something with it that brings honor and glory to him and worships him. So how do we start that? How do we get the right perspective?
Yeah, it always should start, I think, with the gospel that Jesus, you know, he's done this incredible work to where now we're in Christ, and we get to partake in the Trinity as in the fellowship of that with the Holy Spirit in us as well. And so we kind of enter into this world where God is being incredibly generous by sending his Son and his Spirit, and then the Son and the Spirit are being incredibly generous by indwelling and, you know, through the resurrection and ascension of Jesus. And that, you know, Paul, he actually says that we've gained this new heart. So our old heart just wants to earn and protect and consume, because that's the only vision that you could have. That's the best you got. And whereas this new Christian, the person in Christ has the same heart. And of the 2,100 times the Bible discusses money and possessions, the second most discussed topic in the Bible, just about everyone, there's a theologian, Craig Blomberg, he says the theme for every genre of the Bible threaded throughout is that God is generous. He wants to share. He wants us to share. He wants us to be generous. And so now our new intention with money is that we want to get organized. We want to grow as a steward. We want to know his heart, and we will display his love to the world if we excel in our giving of these resources and share really well.
Wow. So in other words, if we get this perspective right, it's going to have a profound impact on our whole approach toward giving.
Yes, on giving, but then also on saving and spending, because now saving is done so that we might maximize our sustainable giving, and then spending is done in a way that we might maximize the way that we give, because you can spend in ways to be generous, and you can save in ways to be generous. So you have a new kind of priority, and I think one of the best analogies to draw from is this Sea of Galilee in Israel, where the Jordan River flows into the Sea of Galilee, and then it flows into the Dead Sea, and it's the same water, and yet one body of water is dead, and the other body of water is healthy and vibrant, and the difference between the two isn't the water sort, you know, the amount of water coming in. It's that the Sea of Galilee has an outflow, and I think for us, when we're thinking about our financial lives, we are going to prosper if we have a nice, healthy outflow. And Paul doesn't want us to just give, you know, he says in 2 Corinthians, don't just give in a way where you're immediately in need for others to kind of bail you out, but give so that you excel mm-hmm. in giving. And that's going to look different for every person, but it's in response to how God's been giving to us in such an amazing way that we can't help but want to imitate that.
Yes. This is where the abut comes in. So forgive me as I pull over to the side of the road and we park in pragmatics for a minute. What about the people listening? And you're talking to folks all across the country right now who are saying, I love that model. It makes perfect sense. I want to love Jesus with my whole heart. Whole heart finances is my goal, but you don't understand. Yeah, but I am literally living paycheck to paycheck. We are barely getting by. You talk about giving. I want to give first to my family, and I'm hardly able to put enough bread on my table. What do you say to that person?
So I'd say as a person in Christ, the number one first step is just to shine a light bright on your financial situation. You know, Ephesians, they say what is cast out, what light is shined on becomes light. And so our spending should be, we should be proactive. And many people who are living paycheck to paycheck are already proactive in their spending. But as you kind of use a budget app, go into kind of a spending plan, that's an opportunity to recognize God's provision each and every day. And you can actually transform a daily budgeting habit from something where it's a moment of stress to a moment of recognizing God's provision, and it becomes what's called a financial gratitude journal. And that starts to transform your perspective from, you know, just trying to take control versus now you're thinking about expressing gratitude for how God's providing. And so that first step is just starts to change your attitude from one of, you know, where everything's not enough to let me see how God is providing. And that starts to move things towards a heart that wants to then, as you see more and more of how God's providing, then that's where you want to start to imitate who he is. And giving doesn't have to be a lot. It's an attitude of, you know, I've been given something, so now I want to express that very nature. And Paul talks about it as an act of grace. Mm. And so who if you experience grace, who wouldn't want to also experience that at a deeper level by imitating that grace to others?
Yeah, well said. When we come back, talk to me about the three elements of giving, because I just gave that example about just getting by living paycheck to paycheck. But you really say that there are three elements to giving. So I'd love for you to address those and how really those three elements then in turn have an impact on our church, our community, and our world. Dr. Shane Enid is with us. He teaches finance at Biola University, but he's also the author of Whole Heart Finances, a Jesus-centered guide to managing your money with joy. The book is not only wonderfully biblically based, but it's filled with pragmatics. And we're going to continue right after this. Anyone can read the news. Every day on In the Market, we're committed to telling the news as seen through the lens of Scripture. As Christians, we must be informed about what's going on in the world and respond appropriately. When you become a partial partner, you ensure that we continue here on your station, equipping the church to discuss current events using the Bible as our solid foundation. Why not become a partial partner today? Call 877-JANET-58 or go online to In the Market with janetpartial.org. Dr. Shane Enid is with us, Associate Professor of Finance at Biola University. He also has a PhD in personal financial planning and a master's in mathematical finance and professional designations as a Chartered Financial Analyst, a CFA, and a Certified Financial Planner, a CFP. So he's got all the initials and all the book learning there is. But he has a heart for the Lord, which is why he's written the book Whole Heart Finances, a Jesus-centered guide to managing your money with joy. So I said just before the break that you talk about different forms of giving. I think we are often too narrow in thinking about our blessings, and we think that somehow it is a mathematical number that we have to give. But you point out that it's our time, our talents, and our treasure. How does God view those? Are they in equal measure? Is one favored over the other? And if you don't have the finances, but you might have the time, or you don't have the time, but you've got the treasure, how does God view all of that? And is there an equality between those three, or is there a hierarchy?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. One of my favorite things to just kind of meditate on is that God himself, you know, for he loved the world that he gave. And when God gives and when Jesus gives, he does all three elements. So he does his time, he does his talents, he does his treasure. And it would be difficult to order or rank them. I think there's seasons I think, would be my favorite way of thinking about it, there's certain seasons where time is, you're rich in time or you're rich in treasure or you're rich in talent. When I was, you know, in my 20s, I was more rich in time than now with a young family. And so I went out and spent more time in hospitals and in kind of the inner city. Now I'm much less rich in time, but I'm entering into peak earnings. So I'm probably more rich in treasure than I normally would be. So that's how I think about it.
I love your answer. And I think the seasons part of that is very important as well. So let me ask some very pragmatics, because if Jesus is in the center of this, and he's a very pragmatic God, by the way, I love the way Paul talks when he's on his missionary journeys about getting your house in order financially before I get there. And Lydia helping to fund the advancement of the gospel and the missionary journeys as well. So, and Book of Proverbs, by the way, talking about debt and loaning and all of those other wonderful things and some of those 2,100 passages you referred to before. So let me ask some pragmatics. Is it wrong for a Christian to have a credit card?
You know, I think we can't necessarily go into the wrong or right. It's more, is it wise? Wisdom is this right application of information and of truth. And so I tend to think credit cards, they're two products in one. So they are a facilitator, a medium of exchange where you can use it to buy things without cash. But then they're also a lender where you can use them to borrow money. So in terms of wisdom, I think the lender part of a credit card is a very dangerous, predatory product that wants to rule and reign over your sovereignty. And that's in terms of, I think it's unwise to use a credit card to borrow money. But then within the other side of it, the medium of exchange, to use a credit card to get some cash back or some travel points, as long as you're paying off the bill at the end of the month, I still think it's dangerous and it may be unwise. But I tend to create some boundaries. And so if at any point you don't pay off your bill at the end of the month, or at any point you use more than 30% of the credit available to you, you've now entered into a place where you're either harming your credit score, which is detrimental to your financial life, or you're harming your ability to be debt-free if you're using it to borrow money. So it's kind of like having a pet snake where it's kind of this party trick that's kind of fun. But man, if you're not careful, it could just, you know, bite you and be not fun at all. So it just treat it. And it is one of the best ways to improve your credit score is to have a credit card. If you want to get into that 800 plus score, which gives you the lowest possible mortgage rates and gives you more access to housing opportunities and to some other perks, what I recommend, if you can handle it, is you open up a credit card and never use it. Never use it, but just let your credit history grow, let your credit available to you grow. And what you're showing to the world is that you can handle credit. It's just you don't have to use it. You know, just grow that available credit. And then that's one of the best ways of pushing your score into the 800s, which again, you know, I've benefited by having a, you know, 2.9% mortgage. And when I was renting, the landlords always gave me pushed me to the top of the queue because I had a great credit score. And there's just certain things that are nice, but that's the nice side. The dangerous side is it can destroy your credit if you don't pay off your bill. And then it can kind of rule and reign over you if you are not careful.
Well, you've said several things that are excellent. I want to underscore them. I like the, instead of right or wrong, good or bad, it's wisdom. Is it wise? And you made me think of Brother Paul. You have the liberty, but is it profitable? So that's something that we can think about in terms of using a credit card and how we use it. But you also anticipated my question about your FICO score. You know, forgive me for the word picture I'm about to paint, but I've always considered the three major entities who deal with FICO scores as trolls who live under a bridge. They're accountable to no one, and they have all kinds of secret ceremonies where they decide exactly what constitutes your FICO score. Now, that's the negative side. The positive side is it becomes a kind of a metric, and yet it's a weird metric because you go to buy a car, they use a different score. You go to rent an apartment, they use a different kind of a score. So it's really kind of weird, and I heard a Christian financial advisor say once, and I agree with him, that a FICO score is simply emblematic of how much debt you owe. And the higher your number, the less debt you owe. That's where it becomes important. So talk to me about this.
Yeah, I think it is confusing. there was three credit bureaus, and they were just covering a region. And then, you know, they all started covering the U.S., and then it became confusing because why is there three?
Right.
And then there's about, you know, 25 different scores, and everyone uses a different one. And the one that's most important, the original FICO, is something you can't access. And whenever they're giving you these FICO scores, you know, if you go to Credit Karma or if you use it from your sometimes your bank will give you a FICO score. Like, none of those are the FICO scores that are actually used that are actually important.
Exactly.
But I will say, though, that they're close, you know, and they're, you know, the FICO 8, the FICO 9, they're including more factors, whereas it's the FICO 3 that really matters, or the FICO 4. You know, and they'll tell you that it's kind of, you know, you're in the ballpark, so a high score is going to be high in most of the other types of scores. I think they overstate the score on the ones that you pay for, specifically the scores created by the credit bureaus. But I like, so for my students, I like them signing up because MyFICO has an app and you can get one of the three FICO scores, and it's, I think they're FICO 8 or FICO 9. And so what it does is it notifies them anytime there's a change in their credit report. And that's just useful. And it's useful not to try and have the most accurate understanding of your score, but it's useful because for identity theft. And we want to always be monitoring our credit report to understand when there's a change to it. And that change better be because of something you did and not because of someone else trying to, you know, take your credit and take your identity. So I appreciate having a really high score to get a low mortgage rate and to build towards that. You know, you start building your score when you're around 18, and you want to make sure you have a very high score when you apply for a mortgage. But then I also want to be monitoring things just so that I protect my credit, because it's a very valuable asset. If it's trashed, it takes years to repair. And it is kind of like, it's okay to be hated because of our love of Christ, but it's not good to be hated by the world because we're, you know, bad with money. And a credit score shows off a little bit that you're trustworthy, and you don't want it to show otherwise.
Yeah. And the nice thing, too, is that your credit score can be repaired, can it not? This isn't a hopeless situation.
No. There was a student who thought, you know, they'd never apply for credit, and they ran the report for the first time, and it was 25, 30 pages because someone had been using their credit for, you know, about 5-7 years. And it took her 5 years to repair it.
Oh.
So it just depends. You know, if you get it quick, it's pretty quick to repair. If it's been a long time because you've never looked at your credit report, then it could take a long time. It's painful. And so I recommend at least looking at identity theft insurance as an option, because they have lawyers and a whole team of people that help repair, you know, your report if things go wrong.
Well, and it goes back to the proverb, does it not? A good name is to be more highly valued than rubies. So in this case, your good name is reflected in your FICO score. And if someone has taken it and abused it, you've been robbed of a treasure in some respects. So that's very important to do. So in other words, you protect yourself, get the insurance, make sure that no one can steal your identity, which, by the way, is a growing industry in and of itself. And even though the score that you've gotten might not be the absolute FICO that's buried in a drawer somewhere that only one person in the whole world has the key to, the point is it's going to be close. And that's very important.
Yeah.
I'm coming up to a break, and I don't want to ask a question that you can't answer, but let me just give you a question to think about when we return. So you mentioned a house before, because the housing market is in a bizarre place right now. And I just heard someone say that the feds don't think they're going to be cutting interest rates anytime soon. So again, trying to look well to the ways of my household, another directive in scripture. Do you buy a house? Do you not buy a house? How do I keep Jesus in the middle of that kind of a decision so I can practice whole heart finances? That's exactly what we're talking about. Happens to be the name of the book that Dr. Shane Endnett has written, and I think you're going to find it to be most helpful. As I say, questions at the end, thoughts to write in, wonderful, pragmatic, hands-on kind of a book as you deal with this most important question of your finances. Jesus is in the midst of that as he is in the midst of every other part of your life. Back after this. We're spending the hour with Dr. Shane Enett, who's Associate Professor of Finance at Biola University. He's also the author of the book Whole Heart Finances, a Jesus-centered guide to managing your money with joy. So I asked the question just before the break about the idea of owning a home. You know, no one wants to be in debt. And if you look at anybody's portfolio, usually the largest asset that any of us have is our home. It's how we build equity. It's a protection. It's a roof over our head. But right now, the market is tough. It's very difficult. And we don't seem to be seeing any conversation on the horizon that's going to lower those interest rates anytime soon. So generally, biblically, not right or wrong, as you taught us earlier, but what is wise, what's the wise thing to do for a believer right now regarding a home?
You know, yeah, I get this question a lot. And it usually has to do with, you know, home prices are historical highs in our area. Should I buy? And nowadays, now it's both, you know, homes are at historical highs and interest rates are at much higher levels than they normally are. And so I tend to have two kind of general principles. We have the privilege of having a good father who's taking care of us. And so we don't have to be in a hurry. I think that's the top principle. Often when people get panicked about their neighbors and their friends having access to equity and having it grow, and they view rent as just throwing money away, they get panicked. And usually short-term type of focused actions tend to, they tend to fall prey to bad schemes, bad financial schemes that end up, you know, causing financial destruction. And so first, don't panic, you know, let the Lord be someone who's going to provide. And then second, you know, the main thing that I think is important to recognize is with a home, if you can be in a home for at least 10 years, then you'll ride out a cycle, a housing cycle. And so for me, I didn't think I'd own a home until, or at least be in a position to own a home until I was in a stable career. You know, and I had my financial career, but then I changed careers from the industry of finance and investing to academia. And I knew that was going to happen, and I was waiting, and I waited till everything was stable again, and that I wasn't going to move or have radical changes to my income. And then it was kind of in that moment, I didn't care so much where that we were in the housing cycle. I just said, I'm going to be able to ride it out. And it's great if I get to buy it at the low of the cycle. It's a bummer if I have to buy it at the height of the cycle, but having that 10-year horizon, a general perception that you'll probably be in your same place, same job over that time frame, that's to me one of the top kind of criteria for buying a home, not let's just wait around until the market crashes, because there's just so many people who have done that, and then the homes just keep getting expensive, mm-hmm. And so you just kind of get left behind. And, you know, I will say if the market crashes, then do all you can to see if you can buy, but in lieu of a crash, it's, you know, why not just, if you have stable income, you have a situation where you think you'll be, you know, put for a while with a reasonable expectation, then go ahead and buy, you know, put yourself in a position to buy a house and then just let the cycle move through. And over time, it should be fine.
That's good counsel. What happens if a husband and wife have different financial personalities? We all do have a personality when it comes to our finances. And they say that if you're not arguing about sex in a marriage, you're arguing about money. What counsel do you give to people in that area?
So the top first step is to identify how you relate to money. And, you know, Whole Heart Finances has a chapter about two different schemes for identifying a money personality. And so most likely you've married someone who has a different money personality than yourself. And it's great to know what that is. And not just that it's different and the other person's is worse than yours. And so once you can kind of identify the money personality of your spouse or partner, then the next step is to find all of the good of that personality and really celebrate that and recognize just how amazing and unique and what that money personality has to bring to the relationship. And once you can do that, you know, you gather a lot of really valuable empathy, and it's neat to see how you're able to really enrich each other. And then the last step would be to identify in what way that your money personality goes awry goes into bad places, gets unhealthy, and starts to work on a plan to help, deviate or improve or heal things, that those moments, and find the patterns, and, you know, basically don't, what you don't want to do is look at the weaknesses of your spouse's or your partner's money personality and then say, let's fix that. Instead, you want to look at your own weaknesses and then maybe work together. So, you know, for example, for me, there's a neat way to identify a money personality where you look at your degree of looseness or tightness. So is it painful or is it fun to spend money? And then you also look at how much pleasure you derive from material possessions. Do you experience life through material things or not? And that puts you on a grid of a money personality. And so for me, I'm naturally a little bit loose with money and a little bit slow in my enjoyment of material things. And that makes me an experiencer. And so I kind of want to spend money to experience things, you know, for travel and for, you know, I don't want to buy a boat. I don't want to buy a car. I don't want to buy these things. But I do want to spend money on experiences. And, but when I'm unhealthy, I go tight. So I don't change my level of materialism. I never like things in general, but I will become like a non-spender. And then I'll try and control everyone else around me to try and not spend any money. And so it's good for me to identify that, and I can tell I'm not gazing at the Lord. I'm not seeing His beauty and His love and His promises of provision. And so that just kind of helps me work towards a healthier relationship to money.
Wow. I have so many questions to ask you, and the hour's just flown by. So let me ask this as a concluding question. I want Jesus in the middle of my financial decisions. He gave me the blessings. I'm in a management position. I can honor and glorify Him just by the way that I handle my money. Where do I start? If someone listening to you today said, I want that. I want whole heart finances. I want Jesus to be in the center of all my decisions about money. Where do we start?
I'd say it starts with being intentional. Decide what do you want? Do you want, what type of spending life and financial life do you want? How much do you want to save and give? Like, what is your dream? Mm-hmm. Get aspirational. Decide as a Christian, you know, what would be my dream scenario between saving, giving, and spending?
Perfect. And Let me stop it there only because I'm out of time, and there's so much more where that came from. Dr. Shane Enid, thank you for the gift of your time, and thank you for a fabulous book, Whole Heart Finances, A Jesus-Centered Guide to Managing Your Money with Joy. Thank you so much, friends. We'll see you next time.